This podcast is being recorded at Douglas College in New Westminster, British Columbia, which is located on the unceded traditional and ancestral territories of the Kakait and Kwikwetlem First Nations. We are fortunate to be able to gather on this territory of the Coast Salish peoples, where we honor their welcome and graciousness to the students who seek knowledge here. Thank you.
Welcome to Shift, Let's Talk. In our first edition, we have Dr. Caitlin Albert, PhD from University of Toronto. Thank you for joining us and flying all the way from Toronto. I'm Anna Brito, and also with us, Seren Frisky.
Thank you for joining us today. This podcast is part of the Impact series of speaking events. Episodes will focus on sexual health, dating, sexual violence, and intersectionality issues.
Today, Caitlin will be sharing with us her experience regarding her research on unwanted sexual experiences in post-secondary institutions. Thank you very much for being here and recording this podcast with us.
And thank you for having me all the way from Toronto. It's great to be back.
Thank you. Okay, so our very first question is, how did this project, 60 Days in the Life of a Student, get started? Can you tell us about this project a little bit?
Mm-hmm. So we started this project, I would say, about 3 years ago. We had a group of collaborators, Eric Schneiderhan and Anna Kortevag out of the University of Toronto Sociology, really wanted to get a version of this project going. So I was hired initially as a research assistant, and we put together a team of about, 16 interdisciplinary scholars, and we built this project up from the ground. We had a guide, in some ways we had a collaborator with Seamus Khan from Columbia University, and they had done a similar project. So we were sort of trying to do something similar to what was done there. And we designed this and got it up off the ground in about 3 years, yeah.
So in your experience, next question, mm-hmm. Has campus culture changed over the years concerning sexual behavior?
Yeah, so campus culture. I think it's hard to say if campus culture has really changed. I think there's been sort of a shift in culture around sex and sexualities and sexual behavior. And I think there is a shift in terms of like awareness and education, you know, around things like consent and wantedness and awareness about sort of the frequency of incidents of sexual violence on campuses and awareness about peer support. Resources are popping up on campuses and bystander intervention. So I think there's been a shift in campus responses towards policy and programs. I'm not sure that culture has really shifted enough. I think culture and policies and awareness has shifted, and that's great, but I don't really think there's been a huge shift in culture necessarily. We're starting to see it, but I don't think culture itself has shifted enough yet. I think we're looking at policy interventions, which are great, but not necessarily enough in terms of everyday sexual experiences.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And did you find any pushback on this research? Do you feel like it was well received? Do you feel that there's pushback to comprehensive sex education? And why do you think that's the case?
I think that's a good question to follow up, a question about changes in culture, especially. We knew that our research was going to be different from other studies that were done. We were, as opposed to a campus climate survey, which are really great, they give you sort of statistics and information about victimization patterns, but we set out to do a diary project. I didn't introduce it at the beginning. So we wanted to get students every single day for 5 minutes a day to fill out questions about their sexual experiences and their mental health. So for 60 days, we tracked this. And so I wouldn't say there was pushback necessarily, but I think that our research immediately, the fact we were asking every single day, was going to report higher incident rates than we're used to seeing in a lot of the statistics and information that is publicly available. So I'm not sure there was pushback, but we didn't seek out university support for this necessarily in terms of financial backing. We did have some, but we were doing this very independently. So there wasn't pushback towards the research itself. But then the second part of your question was around comprehensive sex ed, right? Yeah. I think that's also a great question to follow up with, thinking about shifts in culture. So, there's a lot of pushback around comprehensive sex ed. Yeah. I'm only really familiar with the Ontario context because that's where I live. And part of my research, actually, in a different project, looks at comprehensive and sex education in Ontario. So I went into schools in one of the Ontario school districts and did a small ethnography in health classes there. And this was in 2015, and that was just within weeks of getting a new Liberal majority government. And Kathleen Wynne, who was Ontario's first openly gay premier, she updated Ontario's school-based sex education, really to one that wasn't just on sexual health, but sexualities. And I don't know if you remember this happening. Yeah, but there was really big pushback from parents and politicians. They really expressed concern over introduction of topics like diverse families, masturbation, sexting, gender identity, gender orientation, sexual orientation. And I think there's pushback to comprehensive sex ed because it's really reigniting culture wars and old debates about abstinence only, comprehensive sex ed. But I think if we look at comprehensive sex ed, there's a lot that overlaps with other forms of sex education. So I think the pushback comes because people just aren't really aware what's in sex education in general. And so linking it back to thinking about shifts in culture, it's really too bad that we have this pushback against comprehensive sex ed, because I think if we want to shift culture and not just make policies, we need to have sex education. I think we need to pass comprehensive sex ed. We'll be talking about this later, maybe moving more towards like a ethics-based or social justice-based sex education in and outside of schools. Sharon Lam has really great work on this, but I think that's tied to culture as well.
So do you think that the lack of knowledge also helps with the fear of sex educating kids, right? Because parents don't really know what's going on, and they're afraid of, just not being able to raise their kids the way they want, or...
I think lack of knowledge is one reason.
Yeah.
I think that parents sometimes do have the knowledge that's available to them, but I think that parents are tasked with a lot of contentious situations, and so parents might be trying to figure out how this fits in with their religious beliefs or their cultural beliefs, or other beliefs that they might have. And so it's not necessarily always just a lack of information. I think one of the things that we expect is if we just educate people on anything, my research is also in vaccines, we're going to get more people vaccinating. But it's what we do with the knowledge. And I think part of, even with students, what we have to do is helping them think about how it fits into their lives. So not just giving more scientific information and not just giving parents more information, but thinking about what it means in terms of their other life responsibilities. Because there is tension and parents have to make choices and their moral choices. So I think not just more information, but trying to figure out how to make negotiated in the context of really diverse things that parents have to negotiate.
Yeah, I read your paper regarding vaccines and those who vaccinate or don't vaccinate their kids, and what those vaccines mean, if they mean that they're going to be more sexually active younger or not. So I get what you say about responsibilities. I think that being a parent is not easy when you have to make those choices, because it's not only about what you have available, but it's also family issues, moral, history, background, like so many factors, right? And that's really interesting.
I'll also just follow up with, even thinking about the children or the youth in the classrooms receiving the sex ed, a lot of students are sitting in these sex ed classes thinking about what their parents want them to know, or thinking that, their parents are at odds with this education. So I think part of it is like we're schooling them in a way where it doesn't align with their family. And so we have a temptation to remove religion from the classroom and remove culture from the classroom in order to make it equitable. But I think that alienates a lot of students. And so I think just implementing a comprehensive curriculum is really just, in itself, not enough sometimes. And we also know that even with, and one of the papers I'm working on now looks at, even within progressive comprehensive sex ed, it's often still taught in a way that reproduces racial inequalities, inequalities of class, race, and gender, and really excludes LGBTQ youth, and those sorts of things. So the curriculum itself is one thing, but then what we do with it is an entirely another. And so going back to my research on campus-based sexual violence, I think that we need to link up youth-based sexual health knowledge and campus-based sex experiences big time.
Yeah, so just going back to the 60 days in the life of a student, was there something surprising that came out of that research?
Yeah, I think that what's surprising, unfortunately, is that because we got students to do this every single day, I think that what's surprising is the frequency of it. It's surprising and not surprising. Mm-hmm. We also, in our work, also didn't use the word sexual violence or sexual assault. We intentionally used the word sexual experience or unwanted sexual experience to capture things like witnessing or being on the end of hearing a joke, for example.
Yeah.
We know from other research on racism, you know, subtle and overt racism has different impacts on mental health outcomes. So we wanted to capture subtle and overt forms of, you know, sexual violence. Mm-hmm. So I think what's really surprising is that when we use this broad definition, just how frequent this is. We map it on a calendar, and you can see that every single day has a dot or an X on it indicating how frequent this is.
And do you think this is the case for like all Canada or just Toronto?
No, I really think it's the case for all institutions. I do think that if we do this project, and it's something we hope to do, is expand this diary project to other campuses, I think that we will see that this is everywhere. I think that it will look different, not in terms of rates. I think the frequency of incidents will be the same everywhere. But I think that one of the things we have to think about when we're looking at sexual violence are things like sexual geographies. Seamus Khan and Jennifer Hirsch have a new book out called Sexual Citizens. And it's a great book, sort of looking at their research down at Columbia. And they talk about sexual geographies. These are the actual background and context and the world around where this is happening. And I think that focusing on sexual geographies or the actual buildings, the institutions, is it a rural campus? We have to focus on the space that it's occurring in. So I don't think incidents will be, you know, frequency is going to be really high everywhere. But what that means for the campus itself will be different. For example, is it a rural campus? We know that, you know, if you're a low-income student, you might not be able to afford a taxi ride home, for example. Are you walking home at night? What access to resources do you have? We know that space and place are, you know, laden with power. And in those spaces, not everyone has equal access to power. So I think looking rural, urban, you know, linking it up with the type of sex education we have in the provinces, I think the culture will look different, but the incident rates are going to be high everywhere.
Yeah. So from your website, I learned that you interact with a lot of your students and you help students achieve kind of the things that they're working on in their careers. And so why would it be important for students to join in on research such as this? And what are the benefits for students as research assistants?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this project is, it's about students. It's about life on campus. And so I think that this research is for students and for life on campus. So I think that it would be really great to be involved with this kind of work. I know that my project, our project has a student advisory committee, and they were really central just in designing this research, thinking about the research questions we asked. They piloted the project with us. They tested everything to make sure it was just relevant. Mm-hmm. And it was a very diverse group of students. But I think that getting involved with any type of research as a student is really valuable. University has, for good or for bad, become very entrepreneurial. You have to knock on doors and get involved with research. And it's hard to see sometimes the long term where you're going to end up and how these opportunities really impact you. But you learn so many skills. You learn about data. You learn about ethics, procedures. And so I just think it's really great to get involved in research. And, you know, as I said, for good or for bad, you have to go out and ask. So keep your eye open if you're a student for opportunities to get involved with anything. Yeah.
Okay, so our last question is, after viewing the results, what do you think institutions should be doing? It's a tough question, right?
Yeah. I think that the response in some ways, I think this will be a two-part answer. I think, first of all, it goes beyond institution to a larger scale. As I said, we need to do work, I think, before students get to campus. Like we need to see a shift in culture. But I think institutionally, if that's where we're looking, I think we shouldn't see these as incidents. Sometimes in an effort to make policy-based intervention or evidence-based interventions, we see things as statistics and incidents, which has, you know, political power. It helps us get funding and policy changes in place. But institutionally, I think we have to see these as part of students' lives.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we need to see students as people who have goals for their future. They have plans, they have families, they have dreams. And so their sexual experiences are really intertwined with their other, you know, life projects that they're working on.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is something that Hirsch and Kahn bring up in their new book that's really powerful, is that we have to think about students as people with lives, and they're negotiating a lot. They're negotiating sexuality, first-time sexual experiences, negative experiences. So I think institutionally what we can do is see this as not a statistic, but actually part of a bigger context of students' lives and culture. But how do we do that?
Yeah.
Right, of course. So I think that we have to continue thinking about policy in some ways. We have to be really critical of what policies are actually doing on the ground level, making sure we have centers where people can go, making sure the language around reporting is what we want it to be. I know at University of Toronto, we're training graduate student, you know, teaching assistants and faculty sort of in ways to help identify and intervene or be there if students are experiencing this. And so I think giving some people the tools on the ground is really important to know what to do if a student comes to you as well. And I also just think demystifying it, not, you know, making it something that, you know, is something that we're afraid to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, for me, why it's important to focus on subtle and overt. One of the findings from my research is that this isn't, assault and violence always doesn't happen in places we think it does.
Mm-hmm.
It happens in libraries. It happens after class. And so our risk interventions need to look beyond, like, extreme places where we think it's going to happen, but subtle moments like libraries or cafeterias, for example. So, I mean, moral of the story, shift in culture, that's difficult, but I think that's where we need to go.
Awesome. Okay. Well, that's all for today. Thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us. And is there anything else you want to share with us or you want to say?
I just want to say thank you for inviting me out here and just keeping this type of research going. And as undergraduate students right now, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. You're getting involved. You're talking about what matters to you. So keep it up. It's really great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It was a pleasure having you here. Thank you again for joining us in our first podcast.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you.
Goodbye. Have a good day.